So sometimes when I'm just looking for a quick laugh, I'll watch clips from the TV show Whose Line Is It Anyway? If you're not familiar with this is an improv show, or got different people playing different games, and the tagline for it is, or everything is made up and the points don't matter. And one of the games, the improv games that they play sometimes on the show, is called Questions Only. And the setup is you've got two people up who have conversation with one another, but everything they say has to be in the form of a question. Somebody slips up and makes a statement, there's a buzzer that goes off, and that person has to step away, and somebody else comes and takes their place. And I thought of that game when I read our passage for today, because I think that Jesus, and probably at least some of his disciples, would have been pretty good at this game. There's a lot of questions here. There's five questions in this passage, and they really shape the message that the gospel writer is trying to get across here. So this is a text that follows immediately after the passage that we looked at last week, that Pastor Barb preached on, and it starts with the next day after those events. John the Baptist actually repeats the same words that he had in the text last week about calling Jesus the Lamb of God. And you can go back and hear what Pastor Barb has to say about that. I don't need to talk more about it. But it's hearing these words then that caused one of his followers, who's later on identified, or two of his followers actually, one of whom is later on identified as Andrew, to leave John and begin to follow Jesus. And when that happens, Jesus turns to them and he speaks for the very first time in the Gospel of John. And his first words are a question. What are you looking for? Now, this is a question that is deeper than just a surface. One commentator notes is more than a simple query that propels the story forward. It is an existential question whose answer is determinative for the characters and readers' life choices. How one answers this question, what are you looking for, determines what you're going to find in Jesus. Throughout this Gospel of John, Jesus speaks of himself in this series of metaphors that fulfill what people might be looking for. So if you're looking for sustenance, Jesus says, I am the bread of life. If you're looking for direction, Jesus says, I am the way. If you are looking for care and comfort, Jesus announces, I am the good shepherd. On the other hand, if, like a lot of people, you are looking for wealth, you're likely to be disappointed because Jesus tells his followers, those who love their lives will lose them. If you're looking for power and domination, you'll be challenged because Jesus models greatness by stooping down to wash his disciples' feet. If you're looking for answers, you'll probably find that he's asking more questions. In fact, at the very end of the gospel, or near the very end, Jesus repeats this question in a slightly different form. Mary Magdalene stands weeping outside the now empty tomb on Easter morning, and the resurrected Jesus appears to her. And again, the first words out of his mouth to her are a question. It includes, who are you looking for? And the problem I think that a lot of us has is that we're not entirely sure what or who we are looking for. We don't know how to answer this question. That seems to be the case for the disciples in our text for today, because they demonstrate their ability to play that game of questions only, because when Jesus says, what are you looking for, they respond with another question. Where are you staying? Seems like they've changed the subject here a bit. They can't answer Jesus' questions, so they come up with one of their own. But whether they are aware of it or not, they also are asking a question with great existential weight. Where are you staying? The word that's translated here as stay is one that's appeared already in the gospel when John says that he sees the Spirit descending like a dove and staying, or often it's translated as remaining, resting on Jesus. It's a word we find often in John's gospel, and especially going on to chapter 15 when Jesus promises the disciples, remain in me and I will remain in you. And oftentimes it's translated as the word abide. But however we translate it, this is a word that carries an implication more than just where one happens to be laying one's head that night. As one commentator puts it, this word connotes not only a relation to physical space, but a connection to spiritual presence. And the two may not know what they are looking for here, but it seems that they have recognized that they found something or someone. And they're at least curious enough to ask about exploring further. Now, at this point, Jesus' response doesn't quite follow the rules of the game of questions only. He would get buzzed if he would have done this in on the show. But his response to their question of where are you staying is not exactly an answer either. I mean, he doesn't give them an address. He doesn't give them directions or description of where they might be able to find him. Instead, he says simply, come and see. Rather than giving a straightforward answer, Jesus invites them to an experience. The disciples stay with him then that whole day. As it turns out, they stay with him for the rest of their lives. And one writer describes that incredible journey this way. He says, they do come, and do they ever see? They see miracles, water turned to wine, 5,000 fed with a few loaves and some fish. They see Samaritans and outcasts welcomed by a Jewish holy man. They see the lame walk, the blind see, the lepers cleansed, even on Sabbath day. They see him wash their feet and speak of betrayal. They see him hang on the cross and breathe his last on a Friday and on the first day of a new week in a room filled with scared disciples. They see alive him who was dead, risen from the grave. The point, I think, is this. Disciples are those who want to stay with Jesus, wherever that stay might take them. When you become a disciple, you hit the road with Jesus, not always knowing what you're going to experience, not always knowing where you're going to be staying. And so the story continues as Jesus continues to invite more disciples and as they continue to ask more questions. The text at this point moves then on to the next day. And two more people are invited to be disciples of Jesus. The first one is Philip, to whom Jesus invites him to follow. And the first thing that Philip does is he goes and he finds somebody else to invite. It's his friend Nathanael. And Philip excitedly tells him, we found the one Moses wrote about in the law and the prophet, Jesus, Joseph's son from Nazareth. Nathanael is understandably skeptical about this grand claim, and he scoffs, can anything from Nazareth be good? I mean, Nazareth is a very small town. Not alone on any major travel route, kind of isolated from mainstream society. It's so insignificant, it's not even mentioned anywhere in the Old Testament. And Nathanael, like any good Jew of the day, would have known that the Messiah is supposed to come from Bethlehem of Judea, not from Nazareth of Galilee. Philip, however, has a sense not to try and argue with his friend. And instead, he simply repeats those same words that Jesus spoke to John's disciple. Come and see. Now, that's a phrase we're going to see later on in this gospel as well. A few chapters later, Jesus interacts with a Samaritan woman at a well outside of her village, and amazed by their conversation, she ends up rushing into town, and she tells the others, come and see a man who has told me everything I've done. Could this man be the Christ? And here in chapter 1, despite his skepticism, Nathanael trusts Philip enough to accept that invitation to come and see Jesus. And when he does, Jesus immediately proclaims Nathanael to be a genuine Israelite in whom there is no deceit. Nathanael's a little suspicious of this flattery. I mean, what does Jesus know about him? And that's what he asks. How do you know me? Legitimate question. They've just been introduced. And this time, Jesus gives a response that is unusually specific. He says that he saw Nathanael under the fig tree even before Philip called him. Now, that phrase, under the fig tree, that's one that, that was a common figure of speech at the time, used by rabbis to talk about a place for meditating on the law, or as a place where students would spend time poring over scriptures. This fig tree is a tree with these large leaves and spreading branches and provides shade in this desert heat. And so it was a place that people would gather to study the law. So when Jesus says that he sees Nathanael there, it's not only an affirmation of an actual physical place where Nathanael has been, but it's an affirmation of him as a faithful student of the law, as a seeker for the truth. And Jesus demonstrates that he knows Nathanael's true character, the core of his identity. In doing so, Jesus provides in Nathanael something that I think all of us are looking for, whether we know it or not: to be known, to be accepted. And there's this very quick reversal then that we see from that earlier derogatory question about Nazareth. And now Nathanael recognized Jesus not merely as Joseph's son, but as God's son, and also as king of Israel. And Jesus replies to these accolades with one final question in our text, and that is, do you believe because I told you that I saw you under the fig tree? You'll see greater things than these. Now again, this question and response that we see here in the first chapter of John is repeated later on towards the end of the gospel. When the other disciples tell Thomas that they have seen Jesus after his crucifixion, Thomas is understandably skeptical, just like Nathanael was when Philip came to him. And so Jesus shows himself to Thomas, and the disciple confesses his faith in terms similar to Nathanael's. He says, "My Lord and my God," to which Jesus replies once more with that same question, "Do you believe because you see me?" Happy are those who don't see and yet believe. So at the beginning and at the end of his ministry, Jesus questions how little it takes for some to believe and challenges those who confess their faith to continue to dig more deeply and discover what Jesus really is all about. So throughout the Gospel of John, we have this sort of constant game of questions only. As Jesus makes these probing inquiries of his followers. What are you looking for? Do you believe simply because of what you've seen here, what you've heard? And his disciples counter by constantly questioning who Jesus is and what he's doing. Where do you abide? Can anything good come from such places? And do you really know who I am? These are questions that we continue to struggle with today, on a personal level, on a societal level. As our nation seizes oil tankers near Venezuela, threatening to take over Greenland, we ask Jesus, where do you abide in the midst of this chaos? As federal troops gun down people in the streets with the support of the administration, we ask, can anything good come from such places? As loneliness and depression rates reach historic highs, especially among LGBTQ youth, we ask, God, do you know us? Do you see us? In response to all of these questions that come from his followers, Jesus very rarely scolds. He almost never gives simple answers. Instead, he responds with that repeated invitation, come and see. Jesus knows what we want. He knows what we're looking for, even when we don't. And he invites us to come and see what his offer of abundant life is all about. Come and see what a life of meaning and purpose and service in God's name looks like. Come, see for yourself. Come with your questions. Come with your uncertainty. Come with your willingness to perceive a new vision. Jesus doesn't promise to give us all the answers. In fact, he's more likely to ask even more questions. But if we accept that invitation to come and see, he promises to stay with us. He promises to lead us ever more deeply into discovery of who he really is, and indeed, who we truly are as well. He promises that we will see more than we could ever expect, even imagine. He tells Nathanael at the end of the text this morning, "You will see greater things than these. I assure you that you will see the heavens opened and God's angels going up to heaven and down to earth." Several times in the service already, we've heard reference to the fact that tomorrow is the federal holiday honoring Martin Luther King Jr. King was someone who understood that invitation of Jesus, someone who modeled a faithful response to it. His message of peace and justice and freedom is one that we need to hear now as much as we ever have. Dr. King was a visionary. He saw something that very few in his day were able to see, something that we still struggle to see today. It was a vision, he proclaimed, deeply rooted in the life and the ministry of Jesus himself. He was able to give voice to that vision and to invite everyone to come and see the world that he foresaw, a world where people are judged not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. A world where peoples everywhere have three meals a day for their bodies, education and culture for their minds, dignity and equality and freedom for their spirits. A world where the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. On the night before he was killed, King delivered what I find to be, personally, his most moving message of all. Addressing an overflowing crowd of the Masonic Temple in the city of Memphis, as severe thunderstorms rolled through the area, Martin Luther King spoke for one last time about what he saw. And in that speech, he describes this vision, a wonderful and glorious vision, just as wonderful and glorious as the one that Jesus promises Nathanael. And his inspiring message that night concludes with these prophetic and challenging words that invite us to come and see. He said, "Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it doesn't matter with me now because I've been to the mountaintop. And I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up on the mountain. And I've looked over and I've seen the promised land. And I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. And I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.